Alaska Public Media presents Debate for the State. And now your moderator, Lori Townsend.
Good evening and welcome to Debate for the State, the last statewide debate of this busy primary election season. I'm Lori Townsend, news director for Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. We are coming to you live from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. Tonight's program, however, is a collaboration of all the Alaska Public Broadcasting stations. Our guests are the Republican candidates for U.S. Senate who have registered at least 5% in recent political polls. They hope to win the Republican nomination in next week's primary and the opportunity to run against Democratic Senator Mark Begich in November. Joe Miller is an attorney from Fairbanks and former state magistrate. Mead Treadwell is currently Lieutenant Governor of the state of Alaska. We also have an empty chair tonight for former Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan, who declined to participate in this evening's program. Joining me on our news panel is Dan Bross, senior reporter for KUAC in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin, Washington, D.C. correspondent for Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Public Radio Network. And now for the rules of the debate. Candidates, we have several segments in our program tonight, ranging from your style in the Senate to foreign policy, the environment, and healthcare. Each question will be timed. First, you will see a yellow light letting you know that you have a few more seconds. When you hear this bell, your time is up. I will enforce this as politely as possible, but I will enforce it. Now let's begin. We tossed a coin earlier, and Mr. Treadwell won the right to answer our first question, which Dan Bross will ask. Mr. Treadwell, you'll have 45 seconds to respond.
Mr. Treadwell, Congress, by all accounts, is suffering a bad case of partisan gridlock. It's been described as the most ineffective session in its history. A few bills passed the Senate. What's the effect of this gridlock on Alaska?
Well, right now, the effect is that many things we need to deal with in Congress are not being dealt with. The House and the Senate aren't getting together. We need to have a House and a Senate that are working together because we need to deal with issues in the Arctic opening up, as an example. Many issues in rural Alaska. But I think if you take a look at the agenda, we Alaskans are part of a national agenda. We are not getting a budget done. We're not dealing with the balanced budget in the way that it needs to be dealt with. We are not dealing with immigration issues. We're not dealing with tax issues. And it's about time that we sent a Senate to deal with the House that will actually get some of these problems addressed.
Mr. Miller, the zero-sum game being played in Congress, what's the impact on Alaska?
Well, I think Senator Ted Cruz put it best when he said it took a whole lot of compromise to get us to $17.5 trillion in debt. And of course, that's not the only specter that's threatening us. We have $200 trillion in future unfunded liabilities. These are enormous numbers. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that it's going to be nearly impossible to pay that back. I think the problem we have is we need to put more patriots in the Senate. I think that we need to have a wave election this November where we can restore the type of balance that our founders intended, where the states are in a leading role so that they can look after their own futures. With the resource base, of course, Alaska has just an incredible opportunity before it. I think that any time that we turn to the federal government and say those are the answers, the end result is going to be, you know, the type of bankruptcy that the federal government is headed toward. I mean, when you're most dependent on an entity that's out there that's upside down, okay, look out, because that's going to be bad for you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We'll continue with our Senate-style questions with Liz Ruskin, who will ask our next question of Mr. Miller.
Mr. Miller, you've called for President Obama's impeachment. What specifically do you see as the impeachable offense?
I think any time that you have a president that stands before the nation, as he did in the State of the Union, he said this earlier this year, that if Congress doesn't act, I will. Or, like he said on the amnesty issue several weeks ago, he said, look, if Congress doesn't act, I will. In other words, saying that he puts himself above the rule of law, above the Constitution, that is impeachable. And frankly, what we've seen out of this president is a whole series of events, outside of just his statements, but in addition to that, over several dozen times, violated the law with respect to Obamacare. He's done other things that indicate that he really doesn't have a respect for the rule of law. Defense of the Marriage Act, for example, refused to defend that before the Supreme Court. I think those type of things where he violates the law, puts himself above the law, that's impeachable.
So just saying it is impeachable?
Well, no, I gave you examples. With Obamacare, dozens of times he violated the law.
So not just saying it, then, the actual
actions. Not just saying it, but actually doing it. And certainly if he goes forward with the amnesty plan, Absolutely. I mean, I think that will create a groundswell for impeachment.
Mr. Treadwell, would you support impeachment, and on what grounds?
Well, I've been asked that question a lot, and I obviously believe that the president is going beyond the law. But as a prospective senator, I know that I will have to stand in judgment of whatever bill the House brings forward. And so I'm not going to prejudice my remarks. I do believe that the House has had a number of investigations into travesties. I mean, you know, the VA issue, the IRS issue, the president going beyond the law with Obamacare and waiving parts of the law but not waiving other parts of the law, where they certainly could put together a bill. And I think we have to stand up with this president. We have to take away his hammerlock on the Congress. And whether impeachment is the best way to come about it, I will tell you this. I will try to go into the Senate to be objective, to work with whatever bill comes forward, if an impeachment comes forward.
Thank you.
Joe can't do it. I can't do it as a senator. The House has to do it.
Thank you. We'll have to move on now. Dan Bross has the next question for Mr. Treadwell. Again, the response time is 45 seconds.
We're nearing the end of a very long campaign, and you've both had to answer a lot of questions, and I'm sure asked yourselves a lot of questions about why exactly you're running. What have you learned about yourself during this campaign?
Well, I think what I've learned about myself is that I really am glad to be in Alaska. I have met a lot of people in this campaign, and I've been 40 years in the state. I've had the opportunity early on to work with some of our statehood founders, people like Ernest Greening and Wally Hickel and Bob Atwood and Helen Fisher and Irene Ryan. And I hear what they were fighting for, and I'm honored to be continuing the fight. What we've got right now is a situation where the statehood self-determination we thought we got, we're losing so many different places. And for me, I've learned that is probably the most important fundamental fight for Alaska that we've got to take on again.
Mr. Miller, along the long campaign trail that it's been, what have you learned about yourself?
How much I love the people of the state. I mean, the fact is, especially the support network behind this campaign, a lot of the same folks that were involved in 2010, largest Republican turnout back in 2010, a lot of those same people still behind us, giving everything. I mean, almost all of our people in our campaign are volunteers. We have very limited staff. It's a We the People movement. And the people that have given up, I mean, some people taking leave from their jobs. We have a number of people that are, you know, foregoing income. The sacrifice my wife is making, my children are making. And it's all because they together believe that this country can still restore the type of hope and opportunity that all of us had, I think, as kids. And they know that with their help, we can restore that through proper leadership in the U.S. Senate. Extraordinary people.
Thank you. The next set of questions cover foreign policy. And candidates will have 1 minute in this round to respond. Mr. Miller will get the first question asked by Liz Ruskin.
Mr. Miller, the situation in Iraq is escalating with the rise of ISIS. What do you think the U.S. response should be?
Well, ISIS is a terrible movement. It's not just one that's helped. There probably are some foreign powers that are helping sponsor it, but it's grown out of just a catastrophic foreign policy failure of the Obama administration. He's created instability throughout the Middle East, and we're seeing its fruit in Iraq. I mean, children with guns pointed to their heads, Christians being killed throughout Iraq. Not just in Iraq, of course, we also see some of that action happening in Syria. I believe that Congress should only act in war with the authorization of the Congress. Obviously, the president's going to go forward. He has a couple of months to get approval of Congress, but that needs to happen. I think that there should be limited use of force, obviously, against those that are creating these terrible things. I think that what we really have to do, though, is make sure that when we address these threats, we do it in a laser-like fashion. I'm a combat vet from the first Desert Storm. That was a war where we did it properly. We had a threat. We saw what the threat was. We addressed it. We got in. We got out. The wars that have happened now over the last decade have not been that way, and it's created not better places to live for people, but actually places with less liberty, not the way to go.
I'm going to ask you a follow-up that gives you another 30 seconds to answer. Where do you draw the line between an event that warrants U.S. military action and one that does not?
I think it has to be within the national interest. I think this concept, for example, that we can export American democracy by force is a failed model, and it certainly does not work, has not worked in the Middle East. It has to be a direct threat to us. It has to be something that threatens our national interest. It could be resource-wise. Certainly, I think that in the violent world in which we live, we have to be very concerned about weapons of mass destruction. But again, it has to be directly within the national interest, has to be congressionally authorized, and it has to be a rapid-fire, clear mission. Don't want to get embroiled in another Vietnam. don't want to see the type of actions that we've seen over the last decade. My son's a second-year cadet at West Point. We've got to be concerned about him and his fellow men that may be called upon to defend our country.
Thank you.
Mr. Treadwell, what's the deciding factor for you in Iraq and elsewhere between a situation that merits military action from the U.S. and one that does not?
Well, I agree that American interests have to be served. I think we made a few major mistakes in Iraq. I met with General Browner after he disbanded the Iraqi army in the first place, and that he recognized was a mistake, and frankly, that caused a lot of the problem with the insurgency that followed. Then we had a situation of leaving Iraq without a basing agreement, and I know a basing agreement is not an easy thing to get, but we should have had a base there. If you take a look at, my grandfather was involved in the occupation of Japan, and we've had a forces agreement there for a long time. We've turned into be very, very strong allies, and it's not that I'm looking to see American power just extended forever. I just believe that you cannot expect the peace to happen overnight. And in this particular case, you have so many people who actually stood up for the United States who may be losing their lives because they did. And I think if we're not aid, you're going to see problems later any place else we are in the world. But I agree that we have to follow the War Powers Act.
And to ask a follow-up, do you think the situation in Iraq now merits sending in ground troops?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know enough. I support what decisions have been made at this point. And we have had ground troops there. There are about 1,000 there. And to me, it's quite disturbing that this big problem is happening in Kurdistan, because that's always been the most stable part of Iraq. Even during the insurgency, I know people in American businesses who were there in the north able to make things work. So it's a very different situation than it was a few years ago.
Thank you. Continuing on with foreign policy, we're going to move now from Iraq to Russia. Dan Bross has our next question for Mr. Treadwell, and you'll have 1 minute to respond.
The U.S. has imposed sanctions on Russia out of concern about its intent in neighboring Ukraine. Russia last week retaliated with sanctions of its own, banning U.S. food imports, including Alaska seafood. Do you think sanctions are a useful tool in containing or curbing President Vladimir Putin?
Well, we will see. Mr. Sullivan, who's not here, chided me for having a discussion with the Russians a while ago, because we are neighbors, and one of the biggest continuing issues for us will always be seafood. And it's important that we keep up lines of communication there. But they've, they have overstepped their bounds. And, we had a situation for a long time where Obama was trying to press the reset button. He left a vacuum. He left a vacuum in the Middle East. He left a vacuum in Eastern Europe. He's left a vacuum in the Arctic, and we're reaping the results of that with Putin moving the way he has. The unified sanctions right now do show the U.S. means business. I think the Russians will, step aside and live by them. I don't see it changing his behavior. I think the real problem is that you've got to figure out what economically can get them to do that. And I don't think seafood is going to do that with us back. It may do it with energy if we got Europe. But Europe's too hooked on their energy. It's a very, very tough issue.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Miller, what's your take on the effectiveness of sanctions on Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think that the mistake that was made is that Obama, again, acting, I think, against national interest, against the interests of our allies in Eastern Europe, pulled out of the missile defense plan with Poland. So that kind of gave Russia a green light to go forward with what it did in Crimea. And then it went forward and continued to threaten, of course, the eastern provinces of Ukraine. We have to have a strong military. We have to have a strong defense to stand up to that type of aggressive tendency. More than anything else, standing with our allies is something that sends a clear signal to the Russians that they can't be expansionistic in their approach. Admiral Mullins put it best, I think. He was Joint Chiefs of Staff at one point where he said, the number one threat to the national security of the country is the national debt. And, of course, now we're trillions of dollars further in debt today than when he made that comment. And those that oppose us in the world, and it's not just Russia, but it's China as well. I mean, China has told us that we can't fly through international airspace now without getting, or at least without giving them notice first. They're threatening our allies in the South China Sea. And this is not just Russian pushback. This is Chinese pushback, because they see us weakening. And that's largely because of our debt.
Thank you. We move now to U.S. policy in the Arctic. where even non-Arctic nations are laying claim. Liz Ruskin will have our next question for Mr. Miller. Again, the response time is 1 minute.
Mr. Miller, what are three things Congress needs to do immediately to address security and opportunity in the Arctic?
Well, I think that there's a need to make sure that we have bilateral agreements with those that share the Arctic with us. I'm completely against the Law of the Sea Treaty. I think the United Nations Treaty on the Law of the Sea cedes sovereignty. It's something that imposes an international tax. It's something that I've consistently stood against, despite the fact that most of the leadership of the state has been for it. And I think that in order to explore adequately, the bilateral treaties is the best route to go without giving up American sovereignty. So I think we have to push back against that. I think that we need to establish a good Coast Guard presence in the Arctic. Right now we're weak on, for example, the icebreakers in the Arctic. It's something that needs to be funded. One of the things that I find very important for the state of Alaska is to ensure that it's represented by somebody that understands the geostrategic concerns. It's not just development of the Arctic, it's also the geostrategic concerns. And so we also need to expand our strategic ability as far as being able to project power over the Arctic. It's something that's to the core, the interest not just of the state and its economy, but the very defense of the United States.
Thank
Did
you.
I make it?
Mr. Treadwell, three things Congress needs to do right away in the Arctic.
Icebreakers, an Arctic port, and frankly, address the Law of the Sea issue. I agree with Joe that the Law of the Sea as it's written can't be ratified, but there are four things Alaskans fought for in Law of the Sea that can help us out tremendously. One of them is new claims, twice the size of California in the Arctic. And we need to figure out what our role is in relation to the other nations' claims. The 200-mile limit gave us a multi-billion dollar fishery, and that is something that was allowed by the Law of the Sea Treaty. Freedom of navigation in the Arctic is very important. Russia and Canada are saying that Arctic seaways are internal waters. The treaty says, no, you've got freedom of navigation there, and it's very important that we press that point on freedom of navigation, and there's many different ways to do that. And then finally, there's one article in Law of the Sea that Western Alaskans have told me is very important, which is we've got 60 ships that have gone through that are last year, most of them carrying oil or oil cargoes. And we don't have an oil spill plan, and we need to work with that. And I met with Admiral Papp, the new ambassador-level Arctic representative, head of the Coast Guard today. And actually, I'd like to invite Alaskans. We put out a press release from the Lieutenant Governor's office, but there's a hearing tomorrow.
We do need to wrap up.
And I think Alaskans can go state their piece on this.
Thank you. The Arctic is an excellent segue to our next section on questions about climate change and the environment. With so much coastline, land, and resources, environmental issues are important to Alaska and Alaskans. We'll start with Liz Ruskin, who will ask a question of Mr. Treadwell, and the response is 1 minute.
Mr. Treadwell, what do you think the U.S. government should do in response to climate change?
Well, first off, help Alaska adapt. We've got to adapt with icebreakers, as I mentioned. We have villages that are the ice protection has gone away, and so we have federal and state programs working together to help our Western Alaska villages. We've got to continue to have good science on issues like ocean acidification, and frankly, there are several different theories. I was chair of the Arctic Research Commission. None of the models predicted the rescission of sea ice that we've seen. We know that the tundra is putting out a lot of methane. We know that there's planetary changes. We've got to look at all the science. In terms of this Washington idea that taxing us more or telling us what kind of cars we have to drive is going to change the weather, I don't cut it. I don't think it cuts it. I won't support it. What I will do is push to have our energy be cleaner and better and more cost-reliable everywhere in Alaska, and I think we can learn much about making our energy cleaner.
Mr. Miller, what do you think the government should do in response to climate change?
I'm the only candidate in this race that believes the science is inconclusive on this issue. And even if it were, I think that still we have to do a cost-benefit analysis. I really do believe that. I mean, we have to make an assessment. If we felt that it really was happening and it was anthropogenic, in other words, man-made, then we have to determine, are the changes that we're doing, are they making it more costly for people? In other words, is it hurting their bottom line to such a point that it does more harm than it does good? I live in Fairbanks. I heat my house with wood and coal because of the expensive fuel. every time that we make adjustments, and I'm not seeing anything in the climate change, the global climate change agenda, or any of the global climate or any of the climate change agenda proposals in the United States that would not have an adverse impact on the average everyday American family, not just on fuel costs, but in the cost of purchasing a car and other things that create, for the bottom line of Alaskans, less money in their pocket to take care of their families. And with increasing cost of commodities, and these are things, especially as the middle class continues to shrink in this country, as their bottom line goes down, when we make these decisions, especially based upon inconclusive science, the end result for the average Alaskan is not positive.
So are you saying then that the government response should be a cost-benefit analysis and further science,
Well, the first thing you've got to conclude is that there is man-made global climate change. And my position is the science is out on that.
Nobody's but what saying, should the government do about it? Should the government do science or do nothing?
Oh, science is obviously always part of it, but you've got to do a cost-benefit analysis of this. It says, you know, if you're going to spend $1 trillion on reducing acidification or on reducing CO2 or whatever you think is causing the global climate change, you better make sure that it's not hurting people worse. In other words, real people, when they have an impact to their budget, they end up having health, end up having, you know, can't take people to the doctor, things of that nature.
May I just correct one thing? I believe the science is inconclusive, and as chair of the Arctic Research Commission, I made sure that the planetary theory on climate change is thoroughly studied and funded. I made sure that the greenhouse gas theory, which had some models that were inconclusive, continues to have work there. We've looked at what the Earth itself is belching out in terms of greenhouse gases that is a lot different than anthropogenic. And, you know, we've learned a lot in the science. The ocean acidification issue that Joe mentioned is a significant issue. It's significant for our shellfish, it's significant for our salmon, and I don't think you can just ignore it.
Dan, you're next.
Climate change, of course, is all about science. So, Mr. Miller, what sources would you rely on, would you go to for answers when you're making policy decisions about things like climate change, fisheries, or other issues that involve science that, you know, we're not scientists.
Right. No, I'm not a scientist, but I do have an economics degree, a master's degree from UAF, and fortunately I'm able to crunch numbers, but even in that area I'd rely on somebody else to do those numbers for us. But I think, you know, the first point is you obviously get the science from the people that are qualified to do it. You talk to the meteorologist, you talk to the people that do the analysis, make a determination, and once you do, then you've got to run the numbers and make sure that whatever you're doing, if in fact it does have an impact, make sure that you don't hurt the people. And that's the point. I mean, a lot of times these pie-in-the-sky ideas that people have been pushing now for decades, I mean, this has not just started yesterday. There's been an effort to control not just what we do, what we eat, what we drink, but our very liberties. It's this idea that we've got these concepts and they don't really have real-world impact, but they do. I mean, any time that you say, I want clean energy, and you subsidize clean energy, there is an impact. It increases costs because somebody's paying the tax for that. And generally, it also has an impact on the economy because you're taking the free market out of it. And so I think it's very important that we make sure that we're sensitive to the people, because the people in this country have been left in the cold way too many times, and this is an area where it's happening again, in my view.
So I just have a quick follow-up. The vast majority of scientists attribute climate change in part to human contributions of CO2. Would you be looking to consult beyond that vast majority, or?
Well, again, if you're looking at, for example, the volcanic eruptions, if you're looking at forest fires, if you're looking at other emissions that are naturally caused, to suggest that the impact, at least from what I've read and the science that I've seen, to suggest that the anthropogenic or the man-made causation is something that's controllable, that's something that we could expend money on, that wouldn't hurt people, that would benefit them more, I think not just the economics, but the science as well, is certainly not conclusive.
Let's move on.
Mr. Treadwell, what sources would you go to, or do you go to, for scientific information?
I go to a lot of different sources. I know many of the scientists in our state, many of the scientists around the country. I chaired the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, which oversaw about $400 million a year in Arctic science on everything from climate to health to helping the Navy submarines operate better in Arctic conditions. And I will just tell you this, I've worked very hard as a citizen to help create locally based science centers. I was a co-founder of the Cordova Science Center, the Prince William Sound Science Center. I helped get the Sea Life Center built in Seward. I've helped science centers from Barrow to Kodiak and Sitka. I was down at the Sitka Sound Science Center the other day. It's very helpful to have science capability working with the communities because you look at the ecosystem effects. That's number one. Number two, it's very helpful that we have a strong University of Alaska that is doing the work at the Tulik Station and in Barrow, and I consult with those. And
You know, the point that I wanted to make before, and I hope I can finish in time, is this, is that science is always inconclusive, number one. Number two, there are several different theories that continue to have a research agenda, including the human one, and
so
we should support
it. On what sources do you base discounting the vast majority of scientists, however, who attribute warming to human sources?
Well, the point is, you know, you can get 95% of them to say there's that, but then the question is, that's the science, now what's the policy? Does that science mean that we're going to raise your taxes and change the weather? I'm sorry, that doesn't work for me. Does that science say, tell everybody they can't drive SUVs? I'm not going to let my kids drive on these roads without an SUV, and I don't want the government telling me what kind of car I've got to drive. I do believe that we can continue to do more research to get energy to be cleaner and get it, make it work for Alaskans to help reduce their costs.
Thank you very much for your questions. If you're just joining us, you're listening or watching to Public Broadcasting's Debate for the State, the Republican primary debate for the state. With us tonight are candidates Joe Miller and Mead Treadwell. We have an empty chair for candidate Dan Sullivan, who declined to participate. Our news panel consists of KUAC's Dan Bross and APRN's Liz Ruskin. Now we're going to allow the candidates to ask a question of each other. You will have 30 seconds to ask your question, so please be succinct. You'll have 1 minute to answer, and if you'd like, a 30-second rebuttal, if you choose. Mr. Miller, you're first. Your question, please, for Mr. Treadwell.
Mead, just a couple of questions. I mean, I'm going to try to be gentle with this. Obviously, there have been comments about the Law of the Sea Treaty and your support for that. Sure. We've talked a little bit about it. Today, you mentioned the fact that you believe that the 200-mile limit that the Law of the Sea Treaty establishes is something that should motivate us to enact the Law of the Sea Treaty, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea Treaty. But isn't it true that it was actually President Reagan who established by executive order that 200-mile limit in 1983?
Well, that was after we passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1976 and authorized that to happen. But I'll tell you, in 1937, I'm going to go back in history, and there are people listening tonight in Bristol Bay, we had a conservation method for salmon in Bristol Bay that only used sailboats. And the Japanese came in with big mechanized trawlers. And Franklin Roosevelt said, why don't we do a 200-mile limit? And U.S. policy was set at the time then that we didn't. It was not until the Law of the Sea separated out the fishing rights from the navigation rights that we could do it. And that convention was very important. Alaskans fought for four things, the four things I mentioned. The idea that there's this international seabed authority which Americans would pay tax to, I disagree with. You and I agree on that issue. But it does not mean abandon the efforts to get the protections that we need for our oceans, Joe. And I've said to you many times, if you're going to expect to win statewide as a senator, pay attention to our fishermen. Dan Sullivan's not here. He missed a fisheries debate. He's not here for the last debate that's reaching the whole state. And I think it's very important that you understand the needs of the entire state.
Thank you. You have 30 seconds for a rebuttal.
Right. And so, Mead, of course, your position has been consistently up until this election that you're in favor of the Law of the Sea Treaty. The new, and I'll try to put this gently, election eve conversion on this doesn't reflect the fact that you know as well as I do, with 155 nations currently that have ratified it, there is not going to be a change on the international taxation that's imposed or on the regulation of the Law of the Sea Treaty on actually factories within lands. In Great Britain, a factory was regulated by the Law of the Sea Treaty. In other words, a super EPA. We already have problems with our national EPA. Imagine the United Nations EPA.
Mr. Treadwell, now you may ask a question of Mr. Miller. You have 30 seconds to ask your question, and you have a minute to respond.
well, thank you. Hey, Joe, in the debate the other day at the chamber on Monday, you said there's no place for the Drug Enforcement Administration in Alaska. And I am witnessing, as your lieutenant governor around the state, the surge of heroin in our state. And I'd like you to talk to the moms and dads, brothers and sisters, because this is a situation where it's not just what our troopers can do. I've talked to our troopers. It's not just what our local police can do.
I have to wrap up quickly.
The question is, why shouldn't we have federal-state cooperation in fighting interstate drug use, and why wouldn't you keep the DEA in Alaska?
That's a great question, Mead. And in fact, I was a state magistrate for 4 years. I was a U.S. magistrate judge. I've had a lot of drug cases come before me. Drugs are a problem. There's no question about it. This is an issue of jurisdiction. I think the DEA has a role at the borders. There's no question about that. But outside of the borders, within the state itself, that is something of state jurisdiction. This is an issue that it really emanates from Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. There are 18 enumerated powers. Drug enforcement is not one of them. And what we've done over the course of the activism of the Supreme Court is we've consistently expanded powers for the federal government. A lot of those things that the federal government does, people tend to like, but they like them better if they're controlled closer to home. Some people think it's an either-or thing. You can either have the feds do it right or the states do it wrong. But if the feds gave back what is entitled to the states and the people under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, we could do things best. That's one of the reasons why, even though I'm voting no on the drug prop, the fact of it is, I think it is a state issue that the state decides. And the problem with the feds, of course, is when they take a little, they grab a lot. So the DEA doesn't just expand in drug enforcement, there's also expansion in other areas as well.
Thank you. Would you like 30 seconds to respond?
Well, I see a big enough problem, and I see this problem happening to our children. I see it happening. And it is federal help is necessary. Most of this stuff comes in through the mails, which is a federal service. I don't see the mails being a violation of the 10th Amendment. It was talked about in the Constitution. And it is very, very important that because most of these drugs come from outside our borders, we are able to trace from one end to the other. I, too, believe in bringing decision-making home. In fact, I've made that the slogan of my campaign. And I'm a very strong supporter of the 10th Amendment. But I just think you're misguided here, Joe.
Okay. No, the post office obviously has the right to do what the post office is going to do. I mean, nobody's going to counter that.
Well, their job is to deliver mail, and DEA's job is to fight drugs.
Well, we're talking about the DEA putting GPS trackers on cars and doing other things without warrant, expanding the militarization of federal law enforcement.
I don't support any of that without a warrant.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen, for that lively exchange. We turn now to a series of questions on health and social issues, which have been much in the news during this campaign. Liz Ruskin has our first question to Mr. Treadwell. You'll have 1 minute to respond.
Do you support means testing for Social Security benefits? And if so, how would you assess need in an application process?
I do not support needs testing for Social Security benefits. And the reason why I don't support needs testing for Social Security benefits is because all individuals who are part of the Social Security system pay into that system. It's part of their retirement, and it's not a government entitlement. It's not a benefit. It is actually, well, it's called a benefit, but it's not necessarily a federal government largesse. It is something you've paid into, and you're supposed to get your money back at the time you retire. And so I do believe that we can fix the Social Security problem several different ways. And I want to see a tax system that encourages savings and investment. I think you could give people the choice to get their benefits later, and there are several different ways to work to help make the program solvent. But a means test essentially says this is the government's money, not your money. When you pay into Social Security, that's your money.
Mr. Miller, a means test for our Social Security benefits?
Well, first of all, I mean, this hits close to home, at least not on the means side of it, but the Social Security side of it. My parents are almost entirely dependent on Social Security. And I think the number one thing we have to do to preserve Social Security is make sure we address the debt that's stealing from the Social Security Trust Fund. That's number one. But there will have to be adjustments made. I don't think means testing is the correct way to go. I think there will have to be, for those that aren't near the retirement age, in other words, those that have planned, those that have paid in, it's contractual. They've got to get the benefit out. They've made plans for it. They're dependent on it. But there will have to be age adjustments. I mean, we're growing older. As a result, there probably needs to be a shifting. I think that there are privatization things that need to be done. Again, for those that aren't close to retirement age, there have been successes across the world. I mean, Argentina is a good example, where there have been successes in retirement based upon a form of privatization. So I think that there are things we have to do given where we're at with the debt. Certainly, the number one thing is to address the debt. A lot of people think there's this major Social Security trust fund. The reality is it's full of IOUs because our federal government, in committing its intergenerational theft, has been stealing or taking money out of that trust fund to spend on stuff it shouldn't be spending.
Thank you. Let's go now to another popular topic of campaigns across the nation, health care. Dan Bross has the first question and these answers will also be 1 minute.
Both of you have expressed your displeasure with the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Miller, if you could get rid of it, what would your alternative be?
Well, I'm not the type of guy that thinks we need to replace or repeal and replace. In other words, I think that the number one objective has got to be to get rid of it. So if we can repeal it, great. Of course, with President Obama in office, that would require a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate to override, unless this is a wave election, which it may be. We saw Cantor defeated by an unknown in Virginia. There are other elections like that. Maybe we'll get that two-thirds. But if not, then it has to become a defund issue. I do think that there are free market solutions, free enterprise solutions, that need to be applied. And I've been saying that for a long time, clear back to 2010. We need to tax incentivize health savings accounts, and not like the one of yesteryear. They need to be almost unlimited in contribution. They aren't lost at the end of the year, so people just waste the money at the end of the year. And we need to tax incentivize catastrophic plans so that if you don't have enough money in that and you have a major procedure that comes into play, you can have that take care of those issues. But as long as we take out the middleman, we're going to get a good solution. If the person that's receiving the care is making a cost-benefit analysis again, quality of care and price, that's going to restore the free enterprise system so that we can drive down cost, and that's really the key.
Mr. Treadwell, if you could rescind somehow the Affordable Care Act, what would your alternative plan look like?
Well, I was just going to invite people, if you want to stop by our campaign headquarters, we've got a hand-printed poster that says, keep your doctor, dump your senator. And I feel very seriously about repealing Obamacare. But I will tell you, healthcare is very important to me. I lost my wife to cancer. I believe the government's work on research and development to help find cures for diseases is very, very important. I also believe that medical savings accounts are the way to go. And if you're a young person, you're out of college, you've got student loans, you're trying to save money for a house, and along comes Obamacare to make you pay much, much more, and you don't get to keep that money at the end of the year. With a medical savings account, you would. And then I agree, tax incentives are ways to get to catastrophic health care insurance coverage and ways the government could help. I like portability in insurance plans, and I'd like to work to see those go. Some of these things can happen right now, even though we've got this stalemate on Obamacare. I think we can do much more tax-wise to incentivize it while we have this battle over repeal, while we have this battle over defunding, and a smart Congress would realize that those are things that could be done regardless of this other crazy situation we've got to get rid of.
Thank you. I have a follow-up for both of you. Mr. Treadwell, would you go back to a system where coverage is denied for people with pre-existing conditions and the uninsured seek care at emergency rooms at the expense of the public?
Well, I'm not sure you're saying go back to that system, because they certainly have not solved that system as yet, and the hospitals will tell you that. But Lori, one of the things that we've asked for as a state is much greater flexibility with block grants on Medicaid, for example, so that we can offer more in the way of the community health services that we have here in Anchorage and some of our larger communities. So what I said is I want to be able to build up incentives for people to be self-reliant. Right now, you take away so much of people's money with Obamacare, it's going to turn people not only reliant on the government for health, reliant on the government for housing, reliant on the government for retirement, and that's not the way we should go in this country.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, you said you'd like to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Would you like to, should we go back to health care as we knew it before the ACA?
Well, I think that the question, specifically with regard to the limitation that you were talking about, Lori, it's really a question as to whether or not the state should be in the driver's seat or whether the federal government should be in the driver's seat. So often when we talk about what the federal government is doing, you know, my family has not always been in the best position fiscally. And so we've understood the need that government has, that there's a role for government in certain situations, but it's at the state level where that should take place, not at the federal level. And some will say, well, but the state governments, they simply don't have the money. Well, if you shift the power over to the states, the fact is you block grant, you reduce. There are ways to do things in a way that's most efficient, most effective for the state, and is also most accountable to the people that would be receiving those benefits from
Thank
the state.
You. Thank you very much. Closer to home, another major social issue is tribal authority in rural Alaska. Liz Ruskin has our next question. Answers will be 1 minute.
Mr. Treadwell, Alaska Native tribes say they need to enforce tribal law in the villages to protect their members from domestic violence. Do you think tribal police should be able to arrest an offender who's not a member of the tribe to protect the victim?
You know, you're asking about a question in the Violence Against Women Act, and I've said that before Washington imposes solutions on Alaska, that we need to have much better discussion in Alaska. The states already work to enforce tribal court orders.
We have a situation where we've worked, our governor has committed to get village public safety officers in any village that wants them, and we will certainly work with tribes in that area. This all of a sudden plan that says the state village public safety officers aren't enough and we've got to bring in federal ones, when the state has had an open offer.
Tribal ones.
Tribal but funded by the federal government. The state has had an open offer to fund VPSOs in the villages, and we certainly work on tribal court authorities, and there are more we can do with tribal court authorities. So I have worked with tribal courts in other parts of the country, and I believe that that can happen here, but you just have to make sure that everyone's rights are protected. You know, the innocent have to be innocent. Need appropriate defense, and this is something that it just can't be done immediately with a vote in Congress. I think we have to work it out.
So is that a no or a yes on whether you think tribal police should be able to arrest an offender who's not a member of the tribe?
Well, if there is a tribal policeman, and right now there's not a federal program to fund tribal policemen in the state, and there's a public safety issue, I would encourage cross-swearing with the state authority, so that if there is a person who needs to be arrested one way or the other, that arrest can take place.
But not under tribal law?
Well, if it's under, the question of does tribal law apply to non-tribal people is a very thorny question. I mean, for you and for me who are not tribal members, specifically we are part of laws that we are able to work on and be represented, and I would be very careful about transferring that authority to a place where we don't have democratic power as you do this. On the other hand, I'm very much against violence, and I think we have to cooperate on this. We just can't give everybody an ace and say, I've got the solution.
Mr. Miller, do you think tribes should be able to arrest domestic violence offenders even if they aren't tribal members?
I was a magistrate in Tok for 4 years, served Tetlin, Tanacross, Northway, Eagle Village, other villages. I was able to see village public safety officers in action. And so I think in part the question, you have to define what you're talking about as far as tribal police officer goes. I mean, if you're talking about VPSOs, I think that the state can do a memorandum of agreement with anybody. The VPSOs certainly have the right to arrest a non-Native member. And many of the VPSOs that we worked with were Native, tribal members. If you're talking about, which I assume you are.
Tribes want the authority to enforce tribal law.
Right. I think that we have to be very careful on a couple of different scores. I think that we should have local control as much as we can. But it has to be within the parameters of the constitutions, both the federal and state. And in addition to that, we need to make sure that the people that are subject to that consent to it. And as long as those parameters are met, I don't have any issues with it. If you're going outside of that, though, there are problems.
Okay.
The short answer is it's not a cut and dried issue. And this is one where Alaskans should
tribes
be
would like an answer to that question.
Well, this is the point that and we've said this in other forums too. I mean, I think that there are areas where we can expand power and control to provide more local governance. One of the things as a magistrate, we dealt with something called circle sentencing, where we worked closely with the tribes that were with the village councils that were in proximity to the Tok magistrate seat. And it was something that helped expand not just their ability to have interface with the offenders and also bring about some community condemnation, but it was also a way to effectively reduce criminal activity. And so I think that we got to work closely with those groups, otherwise we aren't going to address a lot of these problems.
We do need to move on. As we begin to get closer to the end of our hour, we have a lot of questions that don't fit neatly into categories. Our first is from Liz, once again, to Mr. Treadwell.
Do you support raising the federal gas tax to keep the Highway Trust Fund afloat?
Well, the question, the short answer is no. I think Americans pay enough taxes. I believe the Highway Trust Fund needs to live within its means. And what's happened here is it doesn't live within its means, and then Congress will spend more money than the fund has, and now they're saying let's raise taxes. I very much support having the Highway Trust Fund work on issues that are generally federal. But we're looking too much to the federal government for sources of money in every different area. And this is one where frankly, we need good highways, we need good roads, we need good bridges, we need good ports, we need all of these things, but the Highway Trust Fund has gone further afield than what it was set up for, and it's using gas taxes for many other different purposes besides the basic purpose of building highways. And that's what the fight in Congress was about this year. So I would take a conservative approach. I would say, let's not immediately raise taxes. Let's look very carefully at what this fund is paying out for, and don't turn it into a slush fund for members of Congress.
Mr. Miller, if we don't raise the gas tax, how are we going to build and maintain the nation's highways?
Well, that's a little different. I was going to say no, but it doesn't just
leave it at
that.
Well, I was assuming you would
right,
say no.
Right. I'm an advocate for the fair tax, and I know that recently Mr. Treadwell has joined that call for the flat tax. It's something that I think would embolden, it would invigorate the economy. We're, by some estimates, have $13 trillion offshore right now. It would come flooding back because all taxes would be gone by the fair tax. And it's a fair tax because it offers rebates to those families with children. It's something that would lower the tax burden on American families. It would enhance the middle class. It would also enhance revenues for government because of the significant amount of economic activity, which would take place virtually overnight in this country. One of the things a lot of people don't realize when we go to the store and we buy a loaf of bread, at each stage of production of that loaf of bread, you know, from the point that you buy the combine that's combining the wheat, the fuel that goes into that combine, the transport of that wheat to the mill, the mill itself that gets taxed, the wholesaler, every stage of production, sometimes dozens of stages, tax at every stage, and it ends up rolling so much tax into the product, that in some cases can be the majority of the cost of the product. So I think that that's the route to go, and it will increase revenues so that we can address the shortfall.
Thank you. Now, Dan Bras, it's your turn again to ask a question, and Dan has a question about the Second Amendment. Please
answer. Gun rights are fundamental in the U.S. Constitution and held very dearly by many Alaskans and many Americans. But we've also had these incidents where people with mental health problems have gotten a hold of guns and committed mass atrocities, tragically. Are there instances, or is there a way, you see, we'll start with Mr. Miller, that we could somehow screen these individuals to keep guns out of their hands?
The gun control crowd has used mental health as an excuse to already, with veterans, reduce the gun rights of hundreds of thousands of returning combat vets from the Middle East. My position is that any time that you attempt to reduce gun rights by mental health, there better be a system that is not based upon one statement. It has to be one that due process is preserved. There has to be significant protections. It's a significant right. It's a significant liberty right. I mean, the Second Amendment, a lot of people look at this as something that is designed, you know, to ensure that you can hunt, ensure that, yeah, you know, you can have self-defense in your home. What the predicate for this doesn't understand is that the Second Amendment is a right by which all others are guaranteed. I mean, the founders intended it. And this sounds, in some circles, to be a little bit aggressive. But the fact is, it was designed to be a check on tyranny, that the people would have the ability, if the government became tyrannical, to threaten a tyrannical government. We just heard about this judge's decision in Maryland today that said AR-15s, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't protect. That's an upside-down view of the Second Amendment. It doesn't reflect the founders' intent. And I think that anything that goes forward on an abrupt basis to take away rights is the wrong way to do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Treadwell, what's your take on this?
Well, Dan, I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I did not fight to stand your ground as the guy in the empty chair did. But I'll tell you this, I'm a graduate of Sandy Hook Elementary School. That guy went into that school, went into my second, third grade classrooms, killed a lot of kids. And I obviously would like to see that stopped. I went back to Newtown. I said, these problems can be solved with acts of kindness, not acts of Congress. I don't think it's up to Congress to take away our God-given rights to self-defense with our guns. But I do believe, and I've seen success in this in my generation. My dad was an alcoholic. The idea of doing an intervention at the time, I was a kid, was not really well known. Now it's very, very common with people hooked on drugs or alcohol. We have to learn mental health first aid to help people. And I don't think it's a government thing as much as it's a people thing. If you find somebody who is withdrawing from society, depressed, suicidal, how can we learn as people to recognize that in the same way we've learned CPR or the Heimlich maneuver or those kinds of life-saving things? And the idea that we take away people's guns as the first option, to me, is not appropriate at all for the discussion. The discussion is, what can we do for mental health?
Thank you, Mr. Treadwell. So let's say you're elected. Liz Ruskin, what's next then? Liz Ruskin picks up this next question.
Mr. Treadwell, if you're elected, at the end of your first Senate term, what's the headline you'd write on a story for what you've accomplished for Alaska?
Well, I learned, as I said, from people like Wally Hickel, Ted Stevens, others who fought for our statehood rights, and especially our land rights and our rights to control our fish and game. And I believe one of the most important things that we can do for Alaska is bring more land home to Alaskans. We've set up a state forest in Southeast, and we've said okay to the Forest Service. If you're not going to have development, if you're not going to have jobs in Southeast Alaska, we'll have a state forest with part of the Tongass, and we'll do it. There's the law that's already passed the House to turn Forest Service land over to Oregon and Northern California. I support returning land home to Alaskans. And frankly, we can't compete in the Arctic when the Yukon and the Northwest Territories and Greenland just got all their land. We're not seeing competence with the federal government on development, even where they say they want to do development. And I'd like it to say that we put together Western states and help the Western states bring public land home. And I will just tell you this. I am proud of my record as an Alaskan to get parks started, to do a number of other things for the environment. I believe Alaskans will take care of the environment and take care of the jobs, and the federal government has to get out of the land business primarily.
Thank you.
That is going quickly. A long headline. Mr. Miller, what's the headline you'd write on the story about your accomplishments during your first term?
Senator Miller joins with Senators Cruz and Lee and returns Alaska's land. And yeah, this is not pie in the sky stuff. There is there's been a new view as to the federal government's control of lands. Historically in our state, we've gone after the easy money. The easy money is not there anymore. And so we have to apply political power out of the box. But it's something that the American people are warming to. Government shutdown last fall. One of the things that Obama did is he shut down federal lands. People saw that as political retaliation. I think that was generally how people responded to that. And it started them thinking, what is the federal government doing in charge of all these lands? And then, of course, we had the Bundy Ranch thing that went down. And without respect to Bundy and whether he's right or wrong, the specter to Americans was this heavy-handed federal response in dominating the federal lands in the West. That has changed attitudes. And I think along with the wave election, hopefully, in November, we'll be able to join with the coalition of senators, especially from the Western states, but the liberty-loving senators, those in the House, and get back the ability to actually have control over our lands and produce resources for the jobs and opportunity that our kids and grandkids expect.
Thank you. That's also a long headline. Let's wrap things up with one last question. Mr. Miller, if you could have the floor of the U.S. Senate for 1 minute, what would you say that would benefit Alaska?
I would say that it's time to restore America, that it's time to bring home control to the state of Alaska where the people can have oversight so that the people can actually have control over what their government does. It's time to wrest control from the crony capitalists, from those that don't like the free enterprise. It's time to wrest control from both parties that have decided to drive our country in a direction of increased federal control, not limited government. It's time to stand up and say, we as Alaskans can be that economic engine for the rest of the nation. We can have our kids stay home and find jobs. Our grandkids can stay home and find jobs. No more export of jobs to North Dakota. But we in Alaska, we have the ability not just to do that, but to be a bright, shining economic city on the hill for the entire nation. That's what I'd say, but it's going to require that kind of courage that we talked about before and joining with the senators that are liberty-loving, that want to get the federal government back to where the founders intended and to put the states in a leading role.
Thank you. And Mr. Treadwell, if you could have the floor of the U.S. Senate for 1 minute, what would you say that would benefit Alaska?
Well, two things. I remember James Wickersham, who was our first delegate in Congress, never met him, but he was given a small amount of time to address the House, and about 6 hours later, we had the Alaska Railroad conceived, the University of Alaska conceived, and so forth. The two major conceptions that I want to go to Washington to push is one, limited government nationally. We have a government that spends too much, it borrows too much, it taxes too much, it meddles too much, and it snoops too much. And we've got to live by the Constitution. That's no question in my mind. And I want to see Congress do what the Constitution says it's supposed to do. Secondly, we're coming up on the 150th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase. Alaska is worth it, yet we still have this argument about Seward's Folly. And I would invite people here to see what they, to get rid of their misconceptions and get around the country to make sure they get rid of their misconceptions. Alaska can be a good place for the environment, a good place for people, and a good place for jobs.
and we are a strategic place for the nation. And that's half the job of a senator, is to explain this to the world. And I'll explain it in a minute. I'll explain it in an hour. And you've never seen me stop on that. I am pro-Alaska.
All right. Thank you so much. This hour has gone by very quickly. Thank you so much. This concludes Public Broadcasting's 2014 Debate for the State. Thank you to the candidates and to our panelists. Tuesday, August 19th is primary election day. Alaska polls will open at 7 o'clock in the morning and will close at 8 p.m. If you haven't done so already, please vote. Thank you, and